So this is talking with Jeff Burbage on 7 September 76 at Paris. Well, can you tell me when you first came in contact with astronomy? I think you were trained as a physicist, is that right?
That's right. Well, I came in contact with astronomy when I married an astronomer.
I see. And when was that? That was
around 1950.
And did you know about radio astronomy at that time?
Did I know about radio? Yes. When I was a graduate student in London, I went to a meeting that was held in University College.
Oh, yes.
And at that meeting, this was when the majority view was that the radio sources were of galactic origin. They were stars of a special kind. And I always remember that Tommy Gold got up at that meeting and said, well, the isotropy might very well mean that they were very distant objects. And both Martin Ryle and McVitie got up and attacked him very strongly.
Yes.
So it was absolutely, they thought this was a terrible suggestion.
Yeah, I know that meeting, but I haven't heard that comment before.
No, that was made. In fact, Tommy was talking about it again in Grenoble last week.
Did you follow the whole business of the radio stars through the early 50s? The first reference I have to you is 56.
No, not really. I was working on... I went to the States in 51, and I was in the States at Harvard and then at Chicago, and I came back in 53, and I wasn't doing that kind of work at all. I was working on stars and the abundances of elements in stars and in stellar evolution and radiative transfer. I came back in 55 and I went to the Cavendish, and I was working with the radio astronomy group in the Cavendish, Ryle's group at the time.
Oh, I see.
And that's when I first came into contact, really, with the radio astronomers. And it was at that time that they were just getting into this infamous log N, log S discussion.
Right.
But I was working with the Cavendish group, and it was in that period that, as I say, they were working on log N, log S, but they didn't want me involved in log N, log S. In fact, they were very secretive, as they always are, and they kept that whole discussion from me. And in fact, I remember that they were preparing this first blast about the evolution and the disproof of the steady state, and Martin Ryle went to give the Halley lecture in 1955 or 56.
That's right, 55, yeah.
And they wouldn't, I knew nothing about what was going on. They very carefully didn't discuss this around me. And I got very angry, and I got so angry that I was then, people said, well, come to Oxford and listen to Martin give these marvelous new results, and I wouldn't go. I was so mad. Margaret went. I refused to go. But also at that time, of course, we started what was probably much more important work, and that was the work on nuclear synthesis with Willie Fowler. That started in 54 in Cambridge. And then in 55, after 2 years in the Cavendish, we went back to the States, and we went to Caltech, and that's when 55, 56, 57, that Willie and Margaret and I and Fred Hoyle did the work on nuclear synthesis.
Right.
But in that period, I became very interested in radio astronomy. I'd written one or two papers when I was in the Cavendish.
Well,
and and then I became very interested in the subject in 56 and 57, starting in England and then going on in the States. I worked quite extensively on the radio sources and the physics of them. And of course, when I went to Pasadena, I met Bader and Minkowski. And one of the first arguments I got into was with Bader and Minkowski, who were quite convinced at that time that radio sources were colliding galaxies.
Now, what year are you talking about now?
Well, they had, of course, suggested this in the early 50s.
Right.
And I really didn't meet them until I went to Pasadena, 55. And by then, this was the authoritarian view that they were colliding galaxies, and I very soon decided this was not correct.
Why didn't you like the idea?
Well, there were various arguments. Energetically, it didn't make sense. I didn't really believe. I mean, Bader he was a marvelous man. He had this kind of, he would show you the picture, and he'd say, look, there are obviously two galaxies coming together. And it was never obvious to me. And then Ambatsumian in Russia was arguing about statistics, and there were a whole series of arguments, but they were spurious, as many arguments developed. But again, it was the authoritarian method that was used in astronomy. Bader believed in colliding galaxies because he'd worked with Spitzer on colliding galaxies. And Bader told Oort, and Oort told the world, and everybody had to have it that way, just in the same way that everybody has beliefs now, some of which are likely to be correct and most of which are probably not.
Yeah. Let me just go back to when you were at the Cavendish. Do you have any feelings as to why they would not want a theorist working on this very theoretical announcement they were going to make?
I think that, I don't know. I was not involved. I was not involved.
It was all
Fred,
observers,
was,
I think.
It was something to do with the way in which they work. I mean, I think that I was thought probably to be an independent person.
Yeah.
And they want absolute loyalty and absolute certainty. Margaret used to call them Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
But it would seem like they were going to make such a strong statement about cosmology, a very theoretical
topic.
That is
the way they've always done it. That is exactly what they did over the pulsars.
Yeah. Well, you've now mentioned how you got involved in the radio astronomy. Let's look at some of the specific papers. The first one I have in 56 is in APJE and Phys Rev. Also, you talked about the radio halo.
I started that work.
Cosmic rays and so forth.
I started that work in Cambridge. I think I did it in Cambridge. And that was another field in which that did come from the Cavendish work. And
Baldwin's work.
Yes, John Baldwin had these interesting results, and we were only just beginning to understand the work that the Russians were doing. And much of the work I did in that period was indeed parallel to that done by Ginsberg and Shklovsky.
Right.
But I didn't know it in those days, and in fact, Oort was one of the people who first provided us with some translations of the early Russian papers.
Did it seem pretty definite to you that there was a halo from an observational point of view?
Well, that seemed, yes. I mean, they told me, and they had pretty good evidence, and I based that whole paper on that on that kind of evidence. We used to talk about the disappearing halo. No sooner you've written a theoretical paper about the halo, then it would disappear.
But now, what about the whole idea of the synchrotron mechanism, which took quite a while to become accepted?
Well, again, the Russians, obviously, were the people who understood it most clearly. But I was not aware of much of that, and I was aware of these different mechanisms. Again, I looked at the problem, and Ryle would not accept it at all. He believed in plasma radiation, and he and I used to have the most terrible arguments about this.
For the galactic background, now?
Well, for the basic mechanism for radio emission, for non-thermal radio emission, both in the discrete sources.
No, I see.
And the background was not clearly understood at all in those days. And the argument we had was over the discrete sources. And I had various good physical arguments for believing that it could not be plasma radiation. Alf Bain and Hirlofsen had proposed the synchrotron mechanism for radio stars.
Right.
The Russians had also discussed it, and of course they'd particularly been concerned with the crab, and we were just not familiar with much of what they said. I wasn't anyway. And then by the middle 1950s, I was